James Esposito, and this is New Books in History. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. I just finished talking to Eric Lindstrom about his new book, Ruling Minds, Psychology in the British Empire. This book will be released by Harvard University Press in 2016. Lindstrom's book shows how the field of psychology often cast doubt or even subverted patterns of colonial discourse. Contrary to much of the historiography on the subject, scientists of mental health often question the established conception of normality and inferiority, as well as notions of civilization and barbarity in the British Empire. British psychologists expected to find affirmation of racial hierarchy through diagnostic testing of colonized peoples in Africa and the South Pacific, rather encountered the same abilities all over the world. Discovery of a universal unconscious through dream studies eroded belief in the superior European intellect and showed that hidden desires and hidden fears were the same in Britain as they were in distant outposts of the empire. Aptitude testing further questioned the innate superiority of Europeans over their Indian and African counterparts. Lindstrom shows how psychology was mobilized to win hearts and minds in Britain's counterinsurgency campaigns of the 1950s and 1960s. Administrators borrowed techniques from psychology to know and control national liberation movements from Kenya to Northern Ireland, actively reshaping thought and feeling while casting doubt on the psychological maturity of the colonized. I hope you have a chance to pick up Ruling Minds, especially if you're interested in the role of social science in the Imperial Project. Lindstrom's book serves as a valuable contribution to the field and asks us to rethink the role of scientists in the service of empire. It was a pleasure to talk to Eric, and I hope you enjoy the show. Hello, I'm James Esposito, and this is New Books in History. Today I'm talking to Eric Lindstrom about his new book, Ruling Minds, Psychology in the British Empire. Eric, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming to the show. First, before we start talking about the book, could we talk about your background and how you got into British imperial history, especially in the 20th century?
Sure. I guess I'd have to start with my experience as an undergraduate at Princeton, where I graduated in 2006. I certainly didn't have any intention of specializing in British history when I went to Princeton initially. And I sort of fell into it. Linda Colley had just arrived shortly before I arrived as a student. She's a magnificent lecturer, and that certainly set me on the path of British history, at least in a broad sense. And then when I went to Harvard in, 2007, I guess it must have been, one of Linda Colley's students, Maya Jasanoff, had just arrived. So that's another sort of case of fortuitous timing. And so I fell under her influence, I guess you could say. Why the 20th century, though? I don't have a great answer. Well, let me back up. Why imperial? I guess it's hard to write British history now and not think about the empire. A few people do, obviously, but there are various pressures and reasons for doing that. And of course, you know, one of the great contributions, both of Linda Colley and Maya Jasanoff and many others, is to break down that boundary between metropole and empire, right? And so I certainly took on board early that insight that you can't think about one without thinking about the other. And I hope I've furthered that in my own work. In terms of the 20th century, I don't know that I did set out to be a 20th century guy. I think it's more the case that I stumbled on this particular topic of psychology in the empire for various reasons and went from there.
Okay. I did appreciate in your book the sort of weight of new imperial history is right on top of your book, but it does such a great job of showing how empire and metropole are in this constant sort of exchange, this intellectual exchange, and you focus particularly on psychology and sort of metrics and sort of trying to understand how the empire thinks and how the empire feels and how to maybe mold those feelings in a way to sort of maintain empire in decline.
Right. Yeah, that's very perceptive, actually. And of course, in terms of where this project came from, I can't say I knew that's what I wanted to write about at the outset, as you can imagine. I mean, I would say You know, going back to the intellectual biography side of things, if I could, I would go back again to my undergraduate days at Princeton, and would point not just to the influence of London Macaulay, but of course so many great European cultural intellectual historians there who I crossed paths with at various times, Tony Grafton, Robert Darton. And then beyond that, the sort of the great books which were still hanging out there, Natalie Zeman Davis and Karl Shorsky. And I bring up Shorsky because whether in terms of his book, Fantasy of Vienna, or Peter Gay's books, or Jan Goldstein's books, so many of the great works of European cultural and intellectual history are about or influenced by psychology and psychoanalysis. And those were the books I really discovered and loved as an undergraduate. So although I didn't set out to combine an interest in British imperial history with an interest in the history of psychology, those two tracks were always sort of somewhere in the background. And so I was very glad to be able to put them together in what I hope is a coherent way with this project.
Okay. Okay. Well, also, on kind of going from that, why psychology in particular? Did you think that you wanted to sort of bring the sciences more concretely into new imperial history? Or was it a something that you discovered when you were doing your undergraduate education? Do you have an interest in?
Yeah, so the interest was always there, and I think at some level it was something I wanted to see if I could pull off, because no one had really written about it before, at least not as a trans-imperial phenomenon, right? So if you look at my footnotes, clearly people have written about different aspects of this, right? There are great studies of mental testing and experimental psychology in South Africa, for instance, in Australia. Quite a bit has actually been written about psychiatry, so the asylum, ideas of insanity, the sort of irrational native mind, you know, in scare quotes. So a bit had been done on this in different ways, but I think a sort of big picture trans-imperial approach had not yet been taken. So there was an opening there. But beyond that, yeah, there's always an element of kind of fortuitous archival discoveries. So one of the things I discovered, and I think it would have been my second year of graduate work, mucking around in the LSE archives in London, were the records of the Colonial Social Science Research Council, the CSSRC, which came into being right after the Second World War and lasted up until the 1960s. So a relatively brief period after the war. This is a body which historians of anthropology have written about a bit. This was a way of channeling government funds from the British state out to the empire to do various kinds of social science research, particularly anthropological field work, linguistic work, work that might be of some use to the empire, it was thought. One of the things I discovered doing my work was that it wasn't just anthropology that had been funded by the CSSRC. There were all these sort of scattered projects in West Africa and the West Indies and elsewhere in Malaya, for instance, on psychology. So how do we adapt mental tests to these different places and cultures? Does visual perception work differently with different ethnic groups in Malaya? That was one of the projects that was funded in the late 40s, early 50s. So that discovery of these very scattered, strange, to my mind, projects of research in psychology is what got me thinking. Well, first of all, maybe I could write about psychology in the empire. Maybe there's something there. But also beyond that, it really did raise an intellectual question for me. Why did anyone in the colonial office think that psychology would be useful to the business of running an empire? And so that was one of the big questions I wanted to unravel going forward.
Okay. Yeah, in your book, just as a whole, there seems to be this tension between psychology as a useful imperial tool to sort of understand the colonized and sort of manipulate and sort of manage, but also you show, and this is actually one of the things that makes your book unique in my mind, is that you show that the people, the psychologists and psychiatrists that are doing this research aren't always on board with the imperial project. It often, you know, it's either doubting at sort of the best of times or sort of subversive and almost as critical as they could be while being, you know, funded by the state. So it's this interesting tension there.
Yeah, that's really perceptive, and I'm glad you picked up on that, because, of course, so much has been written about science in the empire or this idea of colonial knowledge more generally, right? And this is a big part of the new imperial history, in fact. Getting beyond the official mind, getting beyond this kind of dry diplomatic military history, which is what imperial history was for so long. I think that move beyond that kind of imperial history is something we owe to people like Edward Said and Bernard Cohn, people who said, we need to look at artists and scientists and anthropologists and others, not just as people who happen to be in the empire, but as people who were somehow helping to constitute imperial power, right? And of course, that's now a really familiar idea to historians of empire, and I think it's a powerful idea, and it's an idea that makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. That said, I do think one of the things I want to get across from the points I want to get across in my own work is that experts, at least the experts I look at in psychology, as you said, often had quite skeptical views about the imperial project, often held quite subversive views about race, empire, hierarchies of race and empire. And so that to me is what makes an interesting story, right? There is a tension there between officials who want to use mental tests, to use theories of the unconscious mind, to operationalize them, to use them for various imperial and imperialist ends. And yet, at the same time, have to reckon with the fact that these experts who are producing the tools that they want to use are not necessarily on board with that political agenda.
Yes, exactly. I think this is a good time to get into the text, and we can talk about the first chapter. The laboratory in the field, inventing imperial psychology. You talk a little bit about sort of turn-of-the-century attempts of Cambridge intellectuals going to the South Pacific and sort of doing diagnostic tests in this sort of distant, sort of almost uncontacted colonial region terrain. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So this is a chapter which is mostly about the Cambridge University expedition to the Torres Strait between Queensland in Australia and New Guinea. I think I said 1898, at the end of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has long been something that historians of anthropology have written about as kind of a foundational moment when really the idea of fieldwork begins to emerge as a central part of British anthropology. And many of the figures associated with this moment, Alfred Haddon, W.H.R. Rivers, Charles Seligman, and others, go on to become sort of founding figures of the field of anthropology in Britain, along with Charles Myers, who becomes kind of a founding figure of the field of psychology. So particularly in Britain, I think people are aware of the Torres Strait expedition as an important moment in the foundation of these new disciplines at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century. I'm interested in that in a way, I suppose, and one of the points I want to make here is that it's not just psychologists or people who call themselves psychologists who were interested in using techniques of psychology. It was anthropologists, and then in later chapters, it's missionaries and it's factory owners and school teachers and it's all kinds of people. So disciplinary boundaries are uncertain, and I think that's one of the points I want to get across from the outset. But the other point I want to make here is that these researchers, sponsored by Cambridge University, many of them at the beginning of their careers are in rather unstable professional situations when they go out to do this research. They had evolutionary assumptions sort of built into the work that they were planning to do, right? They were influenced by Herbert Spencer, by Darwinist ideas of racial hierarchy. And so one of the things, the sort of chief empirical result they expected to find by doing these laboratory tests with the people of the Torres Straits, these islanders who were seen as remote, primitive people, was that their powers of perception, their powers of hearing and vision would be more acute than you would ordinarily find in Britain or in Europe because their higher mental functions, their higher intellectual functions were less developed. So this goes back to Spencer and Darwin and the kind of energetic model of the mind, in which there's a fixed quantity of energy. And if you're spending less on lofty thoughts, then you have more left over for seeing things at great distances or hearing sounds at great distances. So that was the assumption they expected to be able to validate with this laboratory work, which they brought into the field. And it turned out that it didn't work. In fact, powers of perception were not any greater among the Torres Strait Islanders than they were at home. And alongside that sort of experimental result, I think at least some of the participants in this expedition, and I talk particularly about W.H.R. Rivers and Charles Myers, were actually quite influenced by the experience of doing fieldwork, by developing a kind of personal rapport with these imperial subjects. The kind of experiments they were doing required a lot of close contact and back and forth. And as they lived in this community, they lived in a few different communities, but one in particular for weeks at a time, and got to know the individuals in these communities. I think many of their preconceptions about race, about the primitive mind, about the idea that these communities were somehow monolithic, that there was no individual personality, that there was no real intelligence, I think all of those assumptions began to erode as well. So this is really a story about the unexpected consequences of experimental research, which is really what psychology meant at this stage, right? It's a laboratory discipline coming out of the work of Wilhelm Wundt in Leipzig, and really taking the techniques of physiology and trying to apply them to the inner workings of the mind. That's the intellectual background here. But in any case, it is a story about unexpected consequences, and the fact that the evolutionary assumptions, the racial and imperialist assumptions with which these researchers had set out, really didn't survive the experience of experimental testing and fieldwork once they were there.
Yeah, it's interesting. This chapter seems to make the sort of demarcation between 18th and 19th century travel literature, where, you know, Europeans are going to the South Pacific or India or wherever and saying, oh, well, you know, everyone acts like this, and they're sort of in these unchanging categories, these Orientalist categories. And it's interesting that in this case, science disproves it almost immediately. Science, but also sort of human contact and empathy and these sort of more subtle human interactions that they discover in the South Pacific.
Yeah, I think that's right. So, you know, a big part of the idea of evolutionary anthropology and, for instance, Herbert Spencer's work is really built on armchair scholarship, as it was called at the time, right? So it's guys like Spencer who would sit in their studies in London and read the reports of travelers. They would collate them, and you can still see these massive volumes of the work that Spencer did in collating and categorizing all of this data that would come in, and then allow them to arrange all of this data in a very sort of neat evolutionary hierarchy. I do think, not necessarily that the Torres Strait or experimental work or field work instantly disproved all of that, but I think it complicated it in all kinds of ways, and clearly a range of reactions was possible after the expedition, right? So William McDougall, who goes on to be a psychologist in Oxford and then at the end of his career at Harvard in the United States, really maintains his views as a scientific racist throughout his career. He finds ways to reconcile the results in the Torres Strait with his own preconceptions. But someone like Myers really, I think, does rethink his views. Rivers even more so, and of course Rivers famously will go on, along with Seligman and Myers actually, others to work with shell-shocked soldiers during the First World War. We'll talk more about that in Chapter 2, I imagine. But after the war, Rivers will run for Parliament on an anti-colonial Labour Party platform, and one of the points he seems to be making is that our ideas of British superiority are misplaced, that we are irrational in all kinds of ways, and that the natives, the so-called native mind, is actually a lot more rational than we give it credit for. And that's a line which Myers certainly embraces to a less polemical degree maybe than Rivers. But I do think this process of rethinking hierarchies, and particularly the idea of a boundary, a fixed boundary between primitive and civilized minds, I think that does begin in the Torres Strait right at the turn of the century.
Chapter 2, you talk about dreams. It's actually called A Dream Dictionary for the World. And you discuss the idea of interpreting dreams, first sort of in Europe in the wake of the First World War, like you said, with Rivers and his work with shell-shock patients. But it begins to sort of expand to these places in the empire where it sort of slowly these British psychologists sort of realize that the sort of colonized has this unconscious mind that seemed to be only accessible to, you know, Europeans. It's very interesting. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
And the First World War, too. I mean, these things are sort of completely connected, you know, the irrationality of the First World War, but also with this sort of obsession with the unconscious mind.
Yeah, they are connected because, I mean, one of the things I'm trying to do here, of course, is to trace these Torres Strait figures as they continue to build their careers and go on to be influential intellectuals, university professors, and advisors to colonial officials for the rest of their careers. And so, right, Rivers, Myers, Seligman, and McDougall, actually, all of them participants in the Torres Strait expedition, go on to work with shell-shocked British soldiers during the First World War. And so I think in different ways, they're all also pioneers of psychoanalytic and Freudian culture in Britain itself. So there's a connection, again, between ideas of cultural difference and the empire, and I think maybe what we would describe as modernist ideas of irrationality and the unconscious mind and so forth. So one of the things going on in Chapter 2, I don't pretend that this is entirely a novel observation, but I think it's striking that it's something that's happening with the same guys who are involved in so much colonial research, is that as knowledge of Freud's theories and later Jung's theories sort of disseminate in Britain, and again, this happens particularly during the First World War, there's increasingly a recognition that the Western or British mind is not entirely rational, right? That minds are fractured, that they're subject and susceptible to all kinds of irrational pressures and forces. So that's already, I think, disrupting or unsettling hierarchies in all kinds of ways. And I talk a bit about the controversy kicked up by the theories of Lucien Levy-Brule, who, of course, is not British, but is widely read in Britain, and his idea that there's a distinctive primitive mentality, which is uniquely irrational. It's all kinds of tension in Britain, but it's mostly negative attention because as I think happens increasingly after the First World War, people are saying, hey, wait a minute, we can be awfully irrational too. But the other piece of this, as you said, James, is that the same guys who are looking at British minds and unconscious minds and noting the irrationality there during the First World War are going to continue to be interested in colonized minds, the minds of imperial subjects after the war, minds in other cultures and other races. So the character I really trace here, again, is Charles Seligman, who by this time is a fairly well-established anthropologist at the LSE, at the London School of Economics, but calls on a network of informants all around the world to collect dreams. He asks his friends in India, in Nigeria, in the Solomon Islands, in the Sudan, and in quite a few other places, to interview the indigenous people and ask them about their dreams. He sends them very detailed guidelines for doing this. And they then send these kind of dream narratives back to him. And he notices quite a few different things, but one of the things he notices is that Freud's theories of how to interpret dreams seem to work just as well for people in Africa or the Solomon Islands as they do in Britain. And so once again, I think you have a blurring of boundaries, an unsettling of hierarchies, a scrambling of hierarchies, which is being brought about by these new theories, these new techniques in psychology.
Okay. Yeah. No. That was an excellent chapter. I learned a lot from that. It was interesting too that these things, not only is there a sort of public interest in the interpretation of dreams, which you identify as sort of lasting forever. You know, in European society, people are really obsessed with dreams. But it's interesting that this sort of the same sorts of dreams are sort of familiar in, you know, a African context as well as European context. You have this part where you talk about losing teeth is a common dream kind of trope where people are sort of afraid of familial loss. You can talk about that a little.
Sure, yeah. No, that's a great example because one of the things that happens at the end of Seligman's work after he's done a lot of dream collection from these other sort of exotic locales of empire so he tries to run the same experiment at home and really do a more systematic comparison of the way people dream in Britain and the way people dream in the empire and in other parts of the world. And as you say, he finds many of the same motifs, symbols, images, and very importantly, not just the same symbols, but people attach the same interpretations to those symbols. So you mentioned dreaming about losing a tooth is seen as a bad omen in Britain, as it is in more primitive cultures. Dreams of flying tend to have a more positive, he privately says, most likely an erotic association, both in Britain and in other parts of the world. But the other thing he notices when he begins to ask people about their dreams in Britain is that they have the same superstitious belief about the power of dreams to foretell the future. So once again, Seligman, through psychology, is led to say, hey, Levi Brühl talks about these irrational superstitious beliefs as if they belong only in really one sort of corner, this sort of primitive culture corner of the world. In fact, this is something which is all around us in Britain today, even in this very modern society. So when he's corresponding with people who are telling him his dreams, and they're saying to him, this is how I knew my son was about to die, or this is how I know knew my fiancé was about to break up with me because I had this dream. He's saying, no, there's another explanation for this. There's a rational explanation for this. We can talk about Jung's theories of how you might have picked up on subtle emotional cues, and then that gets incorporated into your dreams, and people sort of reject this. And of course, there is a very vibrant culture of occultism.
Sure, Aleister Crowley.
In Britain. So once again, although Seligman himself is in some ways still wedded to these categories of primitive and civilized, he's certainly wedded to certain racial hierarchies still. Psychology is making it more difficult to hold on to those categories rather than making it easier.
Absolutely. If we can just sort of get to the sort of middle part of the book, where you talk about diagnostic testing, and this is really fascinating. In chapter 3, it's called Meritocracy or the Master Race, the Origins of Mental Testing in the British Empire. And it's interesting because it has such a multiplicitude of geographical areas. So ostensibly it's about missionaries in India, but also sort of the Indian civil service. Mm-hmm. But in another sense, it's about the United States and the U.S. has been really interested in diagnostic testing for soldiers during the First World War and then again in the Second World War. If you could talk about this chapter, that would be great.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, well, I guess one of the first things to say here is that, you know, to the extent this book is trying to push back against, some of our received wisdom about colonial knowledge, right? The idea that science, and certainly when you think of mental testing, you think of Stephen Jay Gould, you think of ideas about race, racial inferiority. To the extent I'm trying to push back against some of those assumptions, I think taking on the example of mental testing is an important part of that argument, right? So in this chapter, I try to show that there were very different strands of thought within the empire about how to use mental tests and what they might tell us. So on the one hand, I think in particularly in the settler societies like Australia, like South Africa, you do have what I would consider to be a familiar tradition of scientific racism tied up with mental testing. And so I talk quite a bit about this Australian psychologist, Stanley Porteous, who was clearly deeply invested in the idea that you could use mental tests to document the innate biological inferiority intellectually. First of the Aborigines in his home country of Australia, but then sort of export this to other parts of the empire as well and use mental tests, in many cases the same mental tests, to document the inferiority of the Kalahari Bushmen and other sort of subaltern racial groups, right? So that idea is certainly part of imperial debates about mental testing between the wars. The point I want to make, though, is that it's not the only school of thought about how to use mental tests, that there is a very different school of thought, which I think is particularly inflected by the missionary community. So I do talk a bit about the fact that mental testing, and particularly American-style mental testing, the Stanford-Binet test, which really is used for the first time on a wide scale with American troops during the First World War, as you said, that test really comes to India as a result of American missionaries in the country. And their agenda is not to document the sort of biological innate inferiority of Indian people. They're interested primarily in using mental tests as an educational tool to try to decide which Indian 8-year-old boy is most likely to benefit from a scholarship if they only have one scholarship to give. or how to differentiate instruction, how to decide which students are ready to go on to the next level versus those who aren't. So in any case, I think as the 1920s move into the 1930s and mental testing becomes more widespread, you see a clash between these two ways of thinking about mental testing. On the one hand, you have Porteus and his allies, again, particularly in settler societies, who want to use mental tests to advance an agenda of scientific racism, even of eugenicism, versus others, and increasingly it's not just missionaries, it's also British officials, it's British anthropologists and psychologists who are associated with the prestigious institutions back home, like the LSE, like Oxford and Cambridge, who take a very different view, who say that it's extremely dangerous and wrongheaded and probably not justified to conclude on the basis of mental tests that some races or cultures are inferior to others. In fact, that if there are differences that are being measured between one culture and another, it's because of environmental factors like poverty, like malnutrition, like lack of education, rather than any innate biological difference. And that really the only reason to use mental tests at all is for practical purposes of educational selection or job training or hiring or that kind of thing. In other words, to differentiate individuals within a given population rather than to compare one population with another and say that one is inferior and one is superior. And as I try to say in this chapter, I think that's the vision, the sort of anti-racist, relativist vision in many ways, which wins out. This is the vision which the colonial office throws its weight behind. And this is the vision which really triumphs, I think, at least on a trans-imperial level, right? This is the formal policy that British officials adopt, and this is the model they try to encourage throughout the empire.
Yeah, it's fascinating to read how much today we take for granted that there are these sort of supposedly, you know, impartial diagnostic testing for, let's say, educational advancement or you know, job training, as you said. It was interesting to see that, especially in the Raj, there's this sort of parallelism where there's this sort of old-school Raj that's all about nepotism and pretty inefficient and, you know, very much sort of regressive and sort of slow to change. But there's also this sort of productivist aspect to it that makes it say, well, okay, if this is going to survive, if the empire is going to survive, we need to make this as productive and have some sort of meritocracy here. And it's interesting that they use these diagnostic tools to sort of push the Raj to sort of modernize it in even slightly.
Yeah, no, that's a great observation. So, I mean, obviously we know, from the British context, from all kinds of contexts, that, you know, racism and eugenicism on the one hand and modernization or ideas of modernity on the other can often go together. I think in this case, though, they don't really go together. It's precisely the same people who are warning about the dangers and even the wrongness of using mental tests to document racial differences and to entrench racial hierarchies. It's precisely the same people who are saying at the same time, as you said, let's use these new technologies to shore up a kind of creaky, inefficient system. In other words, the Raj and other colonies, as this language disseminates, the Raj is in danger of failing because we're not identifying the most talented, the most innately talented Indian subjects. We're not getting education, a limited amount of education. We're not getting a limited number of government jobs into the right hands. We're using outdated ideas about privileged castes, for instance, rather than looking at a more sort of individualistic, meritocratic way of looking at things. And so that is an important point going forward, that even if many figures and many of the most influential figures in the empire are very skeptical about using mental tests for purposes of ranking races, comparing races, they do believe in using mental tests, and they're very enthusiastic about using mental tests for reasons of efficiency, as you said, whether it's economic efficiency or the efficiency of the state, a sort of forward-looking, reformist, modernizing agenda, as you said.
Sure. Yeah, and it goes into the next chapter where you talk about aptitude testing in sort of Berwick's life, but it seems to also sort of originate a little bit with England itself and the United States in the on the factory floor and trying to fit the as you say the square pegs and the round holes in their respective spots. You know, finding the right man for the job. You know, if you know we have to identify who's going to be the best driver, the best you know machinist, or you know what have you. Could you just talk about the connection between sort of efficiency and capitalism and these sort of diagnostic tests, you know, in this sort of context?
Sure. No, I mean, that's a great point. So I guess you're right. One of the starting points for this chapter is the observation that industrial psychology, which, of course, has all kinds of unpleasant Foucauldian implications, probably for very good reasons, actually also has a kind of relativist bent to it. And what I mean by that is that occupational psychology or industrial psychology is suspicious of any absolute ranking of abilities, right? And so this is yet another way in which I think psychological knowledge might undermine or complicate or scramble hierarchies. Unlike the idea of mental age or IQ coming out of, you know, Stanford-Binet, the tests I talk more about in Chapter 3, the tests I talk about in Chapter 4 are occupational aptitude tests. And so the person who is a very good manager might not be a very good driver. And the person who is a very good machinist might not be a very good radio operator or whatever it might be. The point being that there are no absolute rankings of ability. You have to look at every individual in a very specific context. And so what I find in this chapter is that the moment when psychology goes from a kind of isolated project pursued by different, but more or less isolated figures within the imperial context, the moment when it's really embraced by the imperial bureaucracy and sort of circulates around the empire and is adopted in a really systematic way, is the Second World War. And it's the challenge at that point of raising millions of Indian and African soldiers and trying to decide who's fit to be an officer versus an infantryman, and then within the infantry, what kind of tasks people should be assigned to do, precisely the kinds of tasks that you just mentioned. And so that does require, I think, the mobilization of expert knowledge in new ways. And so psychologists and psychiatrists who are involved in devising these tests and in implementing these tests really have more influence, I think, in the halls of imperial power than ever before. I talked at the beginning of the interview about the Colonial Social Science Research Council, this new vehicle for delivering funds to psychological research and other kinds of research after the war. I think the roots of that and of other kinds of investment in psychological research after the war really lie in the Second World War and the need to manage manpower in some kind of psychologically sophisticated way.
It is interesting also in Chapter 4 where you talk about sort of resistance to these things, sort of, again, the old school sort of, you know, I would say, I mean, arguably less efficient and often crueler and sort of, I don't know, just less scientific managerial techniques that are in the British Empire that are competitors to expert knowledge. Specifically, like, I'm thinking about where you talk about Jan Smuts talking. He was invited to go to a conference of imperial psychologists, and he refused to go because he thought that would imply that they would have to take African officers into the South African army, and he wouldn't have that at all. Could you just talk about these sort of this power play between old empire and the sort of new, more technocratic empire,
yeah,
or technocratic tools of empire?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. So, you know, many of the champions of using these new tests, and I should say, you know, there are the occupational sort of skills tests. There are also more personality-based tests, particularly for who's going to become an officer and who's not. So there are all kinds of different theories. There are all kinds of different tests which the imperial military in particular is trying to use in this period. But there is a very definite rhetoric built into them, at least at the beginning, at least when these tests are first used in India, which is that human nature is the same everywhere in the world, right? That the leadership qualities which would allow an Indian soldier to be an officer are the same as would apply to a British soldier who might want to become an officer. So there's a very strong claim, actually, that we don't need to worry about racial differences or cultural differences because human nature is the same and because the principles of personality, for instance, are the same everywhere. That attracts resistance actually from two different quarters, and I think this is quite interesting. On the one hand, yes, you absolutely have these Raj traditionalists, the Colonel Blimp types, who say, I know how to work with my natives, I know my natives, and frankly, my powers of intuition, my ability to size up an Indian just by looking at him, and probably also thinking about what ethnic group he belongs to and what caste he belongs to and so on, is all I need to know. I don't need expert knowledge. I can rely on this combination of stereotyping and intuition and whatever else. On the other hand, there are those, including some Indian psychologists who were involved in this testing apparatus, who say, look, these are experts who have just parachuted in from Britain, who are using these theories of Western psychology and trying to apply them here without even trying to norm them with an Indian population, right? Without even trying to establish first if these tests really do work with Indians as opposed to British people. So because the theories behind these tests are so universalistic, that can attract criticism or resistance both from the sort of old school retrograde racists on the one hand and from the kind of cultural relativist Indian nationalists on the other hand, right? So the politics of this are very complicated. Universalism, I think, can be both racist and anti-racist, and relativism, what we would now call relativism, can be both racist and anti-racist, and that's a kind of irony and attention I try to draw at a few different points in the book.
Yeah. So much of your book is trying to establish metrics and universalist metrics and the problems that when you have an empire that's based primarily on race,
right.
Trying to find some universalist metric is incredibly difficult and sort of exposes the sort of the errors in this sort of way of thinking, the ideology which the British Empire was based upon. And I guess this is a good way to segue into the last section, part three on expertise, and in particular the truth about hearts and minds and counterinsurgency, especially in Malaya, but you talk a little bit about the Mau Mau as well. How are these psychological tools and metrics and perceptions used to mobilize forces against counterinsurgency and against third world nationalism in particular?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a really important, I think, hinge of the argument in many ways. It begins in chapter four, I suppose. But here I'm trying to really pinpoint the moment when this form of knowledge and the various forms of psychological expertise, which had been so subversive in many ways and raised all kinds of questions and challenged hierarchies for so long, is now suddenly being implemented and embraced by imperial officials for very authoritarian and often, I think, we can say racist purposes, right? So how does this happen as one of the big questions here? But I think I was struck actually doing research by how central psychology was, both the sort of language and rhetoric of irrationality versus rationality, the idea that nationalism is itself a kind of irrational, even potentially fascistic disease of the mind. And I think the experience of World War II is a big part of what makes many British intellectuals in this period think that nationalism is itself a pathological force in many ways. But aside from the language and the rhetoric, yes, I think real forms of psychological theory and psychological measurement are sort of used in new programs. First of all, development programs for combating nationalism, as you said, so ideas of group psychology. How can British officials portray themselves not as kind of authoritarian figures who will draw opposition from these new movements, but sort of position themselves in a decentered way just as agents of change, which is actually coming from the indigenous population itself, right? And to a really surprising degree, I think, in this period, the training, the formal training for colonial officials draws on theories of group dynamics, Kurt Levine's theories of group dynamics in particular, other sort of neo-Freudian and behaviorist psychology coming out of the American Academy in this period. So there's an important transatlantic component here. But increasingly, to be a colonial official in the post-war period is seen to require real psychological expertise, right? Ability to manage groups and to divert passions into politically safe directions rather than politically problematic directions. And this happens, too, in the practice of counterinsurgency. So I do spend some time talking about the fact that captured insurgents, Chinese insurgents in Malaya in the late 40s and early 50s, were interviewed by psychologists, both American and British psychologists, often about their childhoods and about their reasons for joining the insurgency. They were subjected to a battery of questionnaires and intelligence tests and other forms of psychological knowledge, which was then in turn used to develop propaganda, use particular kinds of images of the family in the leaflets that were dropped in the jungle, for instance. So one of the points I guess I'm trying to make there is that although historians are now skeptical for all kinds of very good reasons about the rhetoric of hearts and minds, right? We know that counterinsurgency was quite violent and coercive. It wasn't just about persuasion and propaganda by any stretch. Despite that, I think we have to keep in mind that the British and British officials and military officers in particular were still quite optimistic about the possibilities of psychology and sort of unleashing new potentials for the imperial state and containing nationalism. And as I said, diverting these potentially subversive emotional currents into safer channels.
Yeah, it was fascinating, especially if we can, you touched on it, and I wanted to touch on this as well. Yeah. The experience with the Second World War and seeing nationalism as some sort of pathological, you know, twisted neuroses that, you know, their experience with Nazi Germany and Japan and Italy had showed them, oh no, nationalism, we have to stamp this out. This is as dangerous as communism. And at this time, these things are very hard to disentangle as well. It was fascinating how much fear of the war sort of permeated into the empire, places that you wouldn't normally think would have this sort of transaction or flow of knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's hard to say on some level how opportunistic this language is, right, trying to portray nationalism as a kind of anti-colonial nationalism as a kind of pathological force. And, of course, at the same time, there's a very long tradition going back at least to the 1920s and probably quite a bit earlier of portraying anti-colonial movements as mad, right, and irrational on some level. So there's a long history there, which I touch on at a few different points in the book. That said, of course, we sort of take it as a commonplace now. We think about the Frankfurt School and the idea that fascism and the authoritarian personality can be, you know, measured as if it were a mental illness, right? We now know that that really is a big part of the post-war period and post-war thought. That idea that fascism has psychological roots and roots in the unconscious mind. I do think there are sort of connections that haven't been adequately explored yet between that European context and the reaction, in many cases, of left-leaning British intellectuals who you would think would be fairly sympathetic to anti-colonial movements, and in fact aren't. They see it as barbaric, irrational, mad, particularly Mau Mau, but I think also the movements in Malaya and Cyprus and elsewhere.
Okay. Well, you know, let's get to the last chapter, and then we can talk about your conclusions and the end of the book. Your last chapter is great because it sort of links the careers of these psychiatrists or psychologists at the end of empire with the sort of end of empire and the rise of sort of the non-governmental organization and sort of American, not so much displacement of the British globally, but sort of using international organizations through the UN to sort of have the same sort of approach towards maintaining power and sort of keeping, you know, everything relatively peaceful and trying to subvert or at least slow down third world nationalism in some way.
Yeah, so I guess here, you know, I'm building on the work of a few recent scholars, definitely Mark Mazower and Susan Peterson and Matthew Hodges and others who have pointed to the importance of imperial interests and imperial mentalities in the foundation of new international organizations. So certainly we know that story with the League, thanks to Susan Peterson, especially after the First World War, but also the UN after the Second World War. And that's what this chapter is really about, particularly more specialized agencies. So I talk about the WHO and UNESCO at some length. And also, as you mentioned, non-governmental organizations like the World Federation for Mental Health, WFMH, which actually worked quite closely with WHO and UNESCO. So there's a bit of an alphabet soup in this period, but I did want to make the point precisely that you just made, which is that the theories, the experiments, the techniques, which have sort of been built up through years and years of experimentation and often were funded by the colonial state, don't simply end suddenly in the 1950s or the 1960s, that many of the people involved in this work did have long careers afterwards in places like the World Health Organization and UNESCO, and that they carried many assumptions with them about the pathology of African minds, particularly, or Asian minds, and most especially the idea that those pathologies were transmitted in the family. So I spent a lot of time here talking about theories of child rearing. And why was it that WHO experts, for instance, were so preoccupied with the way that mothers breastfed their children in Africa and in Asia at this moment when big development programs were coming into being really for the first time? And I think a lot of it goes back to this history of empire, right? Questions going back to the 20s and 30s about unconscious African minds. Is there an Oedipus complex in Africa? Are African personalities somehow different? And if so, why? I think these assumptions continue to sort of live on and probably even beyond the 1960s, although that's where I stop. I think I've made the point in a few different stages of the book that, you know, difference is being sort of reinscribed from the biological to the cultural, and that's a familiar story in many ways. You really see it, I think, in a place like the WHO in the 1950s. And of course, the irony here, and this is sort of driving toward the conclusion, is that psychology in the imperial context or in the international context looks a lot less subversive and a lot less radical in the 1950s than it did, for instance, at the turn of the century, right around 1900. So anyway, that's just a brief glimpse, I guess, of where we're going next at the conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, if you could just expand on that, we can really get to the end of the book and just see, you know, how does the post-colonial, how does this affect the post-colonial mind? Do you think that the expertise sort of brought up in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s really sort of lives on, or do you think it sort of becomes somewhat less obvious but just as coercive in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult question. My own feeling is that, you know, the reason the experts I write about seem like less subversive and in many ways more authoritarian and maybe even more racist figures by the standards of their time in the 50s as opposed to, you know, 50 years earlier, is really for a few reasons. I mean, one is that the state itself is changing. So empire, I think, is taking on a more benevolent face in the 1950s, the idea of welfare and development, the idea that empire is not simply about hierarchy and exploitation, and it's about, you know, providing clinics and schools and medical care and that kind of thing, which, of course, is itself a justification for perpetuating empire. But in any case, I think that does open up new possibilities for experts to work with the state and feel good about it. And I think that's an important change. And of course, the foundation of these new international organizations is part of that picture as well. The other difference, though, I think is an important one, which is that whereas at the time of the Torres Straits, for instance, into the 1920s and 1930s, I think perhaps the most important external influence on British psychology was anthropology. And so there's a lot of kind of, not necessarily relativist, but certainly culturally sensitive thinking, which I think is part of British psychology as a result. It's part of, for instance, a lot of the skepticism about mental testing in the 1930s and racial differences in mental testing. I think by the 50s and 60s, that has really faded, and the major external influence on British psychology is psychiatry, particularly a kind of American-style normality versus pathology model of psychiatry, which again is sort of influenced by the experience of the Second World War and the Frankfurt School and the idea that, yes, some cultures are sick and some cultures are healthy, and we should feel okay about intervening in cultures to make them more healthy. That, I think, is a somewhat new idea for the kinds of experts I'm looking at, and that's why, in many ways, these are less liberal, less radical figures at the end of my book than they were at the beginning.
Yeah, it's interesting. The sort of radicals become the establishment at the end, and the establishment identifies new pathologies or different pathologies in this new intellectual climate. Eric, what's next? What are you working on? What's your new project?
Well, very early stages, but I'm very interested in writing more about the post-war counterinsurgencies, which of course have been a hot topic of late. But I'm particularly interested in the question of what ordinary people in Britain, and not just ordinary people, but all people, knew about the violence of counterinsurgency. So how widespread was knowledge of torture in places like Kenya during the Mau Mau counterinsurgency? And how was that knowledge disseminated to a wider public, if at all? How was it justified, particularly so soon after the Second World War, which we like to think promoted a new awareness of human rights and revulsion with torture, among other things. So really looking at cultures of counterinsurgency in the 1950s, and what I found so far is that knowledge of torture was actually quite widespread, that journalists in places like Kenya and Cyprus knew quite a lot about what was going on, but didn't always report it to a wider public. So I think the question I'm particularly interested in exploring now is the idea of epistemic filters. So why was some knowledge not considered confirmed enough or confirmable enough to share with a wider public? And then alongside that, and I think this will be part of the same picture, why was it that some of the fullest and frankest portrayals of torture and counterinsurgency came not from journalists and not from human rights activists and not from the legal system, but rather from filmmakers and fictional writers and others? Why was it that fiction and art seemed to have a greater capacity for transmitting awareness of these imperial crimes than sort of fact-based work?
Okay. Eric, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.